The new AMC dramedy, Lodge 49, centers on Sean Dudley, a surfer with a snake bite that won't quite heal, a defunct pool cleaning business, and nothing of value to pawn. The show is funnier than that makes it sound because it's atmospheric and odd. And Dud, who's played by Wyatt Russell, has a warm and genuine charm, which you can hear in this encounter with a former classmate.
Does that bottle of Jim Beam come with the apartment?
Christ. Sean, are you here? Sean.
Hey, Mr. Lang.
Hi, Sean. Could you please get the hell out?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Go leaving now.
Wait.
Get my stuff.
Wait. Dad.
Beth?
Yeah.
Oh. Wow, a long time.
Yeah, Tim, this is Sean Dudley. He was my date to a homecoming senior year.
Wow. Oh, yeah, don't worry about it. We didn't get very far.
Oh, I blew him.
I've got another showing in 10 minutes.
Oh. So, how are you?
Great.
Yeah, do you live here?
He did.
Yeah. No, I thought since no one took my apartment, you know, I kind of just sort of hang out, kind of be like a caretaker for the property.
Yeah, last I heard, you had moved to Mexico and you were surfing.
No. I took a trip to Nicaragua. It didn't stay for very long, though. It was...
Oh, yeah. Somebody told me that you got attacked by a shark.
A shark? I wish. No, it was a, thing. It's, you know, it doesn't matter. It's a long story. So, what's new with you?
Oh, you know, nothing.
Well, Jim Gavin and Peter Ocko, I appreciate you talking to me about the show. I've seen the first three episodes. I'm really enjoying it. I talked to Paul Giamatti for Decider right before the show premiered. He's one of the exec producers. And we talked a little bit in that interview about plumbing supplies and Jim having a really interesting entry into writing the series. So I guess I wanted to start with you, Jim. Tell me about plumbing supplies. Tell me something I don't know.
Well, prepare to be riveted. it's kind of a, you know, I come from a plumbing family, and there was a, you know, period in my life where I was working for a manufacturer's rep, selling toilets and faucets out of a warehouse in down in Gardena. So I did that for a couple of years. My father is a plumbing lifer and knows that business way better than I ever will. So my sojourn through it, I was very much a dilettante. It was only a couple of years, but I actually got to know the industry pretty well and really liked the people in it. I just found out very quickly that I'm a terrible salesperson. And so I decided to seek other horizons.
And how did you get from that to the series? I mean, you have a character in the series who's in the plumbing supply business. That's not exactly what the series is about.
Yeah. I mean, as far as like, I don't know, that's the short version is I started, you know, writing more seriously. I took some adult education classes that led to eventually publishing a book about 4 years ago, a collection of short stories, which has a lot of DNA of the show in it. As far as the types of people I write about and the worlds I like. But the script was its own beast. It's not based on anything I'd written before. And the center of it was this lodge. And as the kind of, you know, the organizing principle of the show, and in a series of very fluky and wonderful, you know, coincidences and just movements, the script got it to Dan Carey and Paul Giamatti, and eventually it got to Peter. And it was with Peter and I that we developed the series that is now on air.
Yeah. And I mean, just to speak to that, you know, as far back as Pushing Daisies and then, you know, through a bunch of series onto The Leftovers, I was just searching for a plumbing show. And when I read Jim's script, I knew that's the series I wanted to work on.
Pushing Daisies is one of the shows that this immediately made me think about tonally. And I think partly in the way you describe the show, because I keep thinking of different sort of elevator pitches for the show, and they all sound like a sadder show than what the show actually is. You know, it's a show about a company town where the company is closing. It's a show about a brother and sister whose father died and they're picking up the pieces. It's a show about a guy who gets bit by a snake. These all sound like things that are darker than the show actually is. And I think Pushing Daisies, I think I would describe in the same way. Everything I could think of to describe the show would make it sound more dour than it actually was.
Yeah, no, and I think we had a similar problem on Daisies. I mean, it's actually been fairly miserable for Jim and I in the month leading up to going on the air with Lodge 49, just having to explain to people who hadn't seen it what it is, because for that reason, it just comes out sounding either extremely dull or extremely dark, or just too complicated to be television in terms of people wanting to hang on to something like a reason to watch. Once you've seen it, I think the reason to watch is the way it makes you feel, which is a tonal thing more than anything else. And that, you know, that was true on Daisies. It's true on my favorite shows. You know, things that I love are not always easy to explain, but they make you feel a certain way. And, you know, that's I think, in a lot of ways what we strive for here.
Yeah, and I think the big thing for Peter and I both, and we're lucky that AMC was kind of willing to kind of embrace it, is that, I mean, I think both of our natural modes is comic, not in so much of a punchline-driven sense, but in an atmospheric, almost universal sense. It's the comic universe. You know, so I think I find it totally natural to write about, you know, desolation and comedy living side by side. I think they feed each other, and that's where we like to live.
I asked Giamatti if The Big Lebowski was a starting point for any of the tonal discussions you had, and he said that he didn't think it was. But I see a lot of The Big Lebowski in the Dud character, insofar as him having a very carefree, you know, attitude in the face of things that are not going very well, and maybe some little reference things in the show. Was that not something you thought about at all?
Not really. I mean, I'm a fan of The Big Lebowski, and I think Wyatt, just because he happens to have a beard, and you know, it is kind of a low slung Southern California atmosphere. I totally get it, and we don't mind that comparison at all. You know, I think I'm sure maybe some of that filtered in, but you know, my reference points are more out of the world I know. You know, that it is a world I know. It's I'm writing about, you know, where I grew up and the type of people I've been and have known. And as far as tonally, I mean, I would say the Coen brothers owe a great debt to Charles Portis. And I think, you know, True Grit is their way of acknowledging his influence on all their work, all his books on all their work. And I would say it's less of Lubowski influence than maybe a Portis one. Masters of Atlantis, obviously, as a touchstone. I mean, I think in general, though, as much as I love Lubowski, and it is for me a monument, we are doing something different. And like, Dud is not a slacker. He is a man who had a vocation that got taken away from him, and he is adrift in trauma. And you know, I think as the series goes on, that'll become more clear. And so as much as I understand the Lubowski comparison, I think we're moving towards a more full vision of a character, which we're allowed, which television allows you to do, you know. So that's my take on all that.
I've only seen three episodes of the 10, and it shifts pretty significantly from episode to episode in ways that I would not have predicted directionally that the show was going. Is that a function of getting from point A to point B that you had in mind for the show, and it just is a sort of a Shaggy Dog story, or was there some purpose for each episode to be a bit of a change from what had happened previously?
Well, I mean, I think it was a conscious choice to be surprising at every turn, because we don't want to rely on mystery to get you to turn pages in this story. You know what I mean? I think we want you to become accustomed to being in a world and in a story where you're there because you're surprised by the way the characters act, not by the way events unfold and shock you or leave you wondering what's inside a mystery box. You know what I mean? Like, there's a certain amount of that in our show, but that's not what leads you forward. I would say it almost takes 2 to 3 episodes before you kind of unlearn how you watch most of television in a way, like where you're expecting a cliffhanger event as opposed to kind of just enjoying the ride. I mean, Jim and I talked a lot about just the concept of a joyride and wanting to have a show that you can enjoy and not be on the edge of your seat waiting to see, you know, what's coming, but just want to kind of take the ride.
How many different people did you audition for Dud? I mean, was it a long process?
Let's see, aside from Wyatt, zero.
Well, because the reason I ask is that it's a part that the show either works or doesn't work because of. And that's a pretty dangerous spot to be in for a TV show. And I wondered how particularly you wrote for certain types of actors or certain actors, or what kind of changes you made once you got the character cast. Was Russell somebody that was involved pretty early, or had you written a lot at the time he got involved?
We're the luckiest people alive. I won't speak for Jim except to say, you know, I don't think he wrote it with Wyatt in mind. He wrote a character that we all, having read the pilot, you know, saw fully imagined in our heads. And when we kind of were looking at our, you know, list of who are these actors, once we saw Wyatt, it was all meant to be. And to AMC's credit, you know, they didn't make it a like, that's a good idea, but let's see 5 people and bring them all in. Like, they saw him, they met with him, we had a lovely lunch with him, we all came back saying this is the guy. And then, you know, about 6 months ahead of production, way early, AMC went ahead and made a deal that held him, you know, for the show. So, I, you know, as much as it feels like a perfect match, and yes, it was a huge risk, it was, and we got lucky. I mean, he is Dud.
Yeah. Now, he's fantastic, and I think, you know, he naturally embodies some of the qualities of Dud, but even at, you know, this stage of his career, I think his comic sense is at just an insane level. But he can also go to all these other places, and he makes, you know, really interesting choices, you know, throughout. And so, yeah, no, it was kind of serendipity of, you know, come at the hour, come at the man, I guess.
Well, I don't want to overread the anecdote of his background, but I mean, his father is Kurt Russell. His mother is Goldie Hawn. I'm sure he grew up being in and around, you know, always having movies on in the house, always being on movie sets, but he is completely free of affect. He does not seem to be a person who is acting. And that's a really difficult thing to pull off. And I mean, did you have early rehearsals with him where there were tweaks in the character, or did he know exactly who this was all along?
It took him about 10 minutes in the first scene. I mean, I think Jim and I were constantly surprised and, you know, just kind of happy to see his choices. And, you know, for the record, he really did not grow up surrounded by, I don't know, you know, like from what I understand of his childhood, he skipped a lot of the years where he might have been sort of thrust in the middle of that entertainment world, you know, basically in Canada playing pro, semi-pro and pro hockey. And so, you know, acting's his fallback career. he shattered his pelvis and couldn't play hockey anymore and, you know, started doing auditions again, but probably not until his mid-20s, having skipped a lot of the years where I think he would have been spoiled in a way by the business. So,
yeah, I think just his parents and the atmosphere they created at home, even if he hadn't played hockey, I think he would have a, you know, just he's just a very self-aware, humble guy. But I also think playing professional sports at that level, he was a goalkeeper. I mean, the amount of punishment those guys take is incredible. And I think that all funnels into what he's all about. You know, so yeah, he is a different cat. And I think we're really lucky that he is.
Well, and his resting state in the show is that he's got this painful snake bite on his ankle. I mean, his resting state is in pain.
Yeah, no, our hero is wounded. You know, he can't do the thing he loves anymore. He had this kind of natural physical grace that he could go out in the water, talking about Dud as far as surfing. And, you know, that does dovetail a little bit with Wyatt. And he's talked about it with Peter and I of this dream he had his whole life to, you know, play hockey at this level. And he got there and he got the taste of it. And then it kind of got taken away and he really had to redefine himself. And so again, these little bits of life coming into the show. I mean, the sense of a perfect fit, you know, like we felt that in many ways.
Yeah, no. And I, you know, I think without hobbling him, he is the son, you know, like he is a very charismatic guy if he's clean shaven and playing a superhero, which I believe he's playing a war hero in a movie that'll come out in the fall.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a completely different version of this guy. And I think the fact that we have him hobbled with a snake bite is so crucial to his character because, you know, he is hobbled. And it kind of, again, allows this comic universe to dominate rather than, you know, seeing a really handsome, charismatic guy sort of, you know, struggle. We needed to kind of physically hobble him, which again was in the script before we cast him, but I think it really works, you know.
Jim, you mentioned Charles Portis. Are there other writers in particular that you had in your head as you were thinking about the characters in the story?
Well, I mean, another, you know, Thomas Pynchon, kind of about a more or less about characters than the world of, you know, the crying of Lot 49 is a touchstone for us, obviously. Other writers, you know, Chesterton's The Man Who Was Thursday, writers like Muriel Spark, you know, and there's a host of writers that I could name, but I think we'll let hopefully viewers who are into that type of thing kind of suss out the references. But generally, I am drawn to writers with a comic edge who can kind of paint a picture of life that feels true and by highlighting its more absurd moments. And we try and do that.
And the crying of Lot 49 involves a kind of underground organization. I don't mean that in a sinister way.
Right, right.
An organization that is not widely known and that sort of navigates underneath the radar, which is certainly an element in this show. Is that the part of Crying of Lot 49 that you were thinking about? Or
yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a few other, I mean, just kind of the atmosphere of Southern California, and that novel was written during kind of the heyday of 60s aerospace that had a, you know, a big influence in Long Beach. But what you're describing, absolutely, one of the things I love most about that novel is it's this novel about a secret society, but it's not a sinister secret society. It's actually a network of people left on the margins who have found an alternative way to communicate. And so something about that spirit, I think, does infuse the ancient and benevolent order of the Lynx.
And did you look at a lot of different fraternal lodges, or did you have a particular iconography or backstory in mind already for this lodge, or did that come from research?
I mean, the invention of the order, or, you know, required, I don't know, it's something I've been, fraternal orders, secret societies, Western esoterica and alchemy are just long-term interests of mine. And we, you know, in developing this, the mythology of the order, the links, it was definitely a composite of many different traditions. And we've tried to create something that feels wholly new and meaningful. As far as like the look of the show, like Peter and I, you know, we toured Elks Lodges and Masonic Lodges, and more for the less for the like surreal weird stuff, but more for like the little
the details,
the smaller details.
Yeah, know? I think, I mean, there was no intent to parody, and I think that was sort of the trap of this. And I think you could misunderstand. Oh, you hear a show about a fraternal order. And I think we've all seen, you know, sort of parody versions of it where it makes fun of it. And I think we have no desire to make fun of it at all. And for us, the mythology of the lodge is very specific to, you know, a character, a man in the 1850s who invented it in our minds, and who were very careful to kind of keep the idea alive that all of these things come from, usually from a person, they're not sort of wholly born out of nothing. And so for us, it's, you know, the whole lodge itself is the expression of a single personality that kind of trickles and is amplified, you know, through time, but it's not meant to make fun of anything.
AMC is using the word fable in a lot of their marketing. Is that something that you called the show as you were making it?
Yeah, that was, I think, a huge leap for us. Coming off the pilot script was trying to find a framework to make a series. And I think, you know, what we landed on was to recognize that we have sort of a knight squire tale, a quest, you know, a wounded squire befriends a knight in the first season. And once we had that in place, we could kind of assign these almost mythological archetypes to all the characters, and it allowed us to break story in a way that kept it kind of simple and fun. We were always careful to be able to tell stories, you know, as we might tell a child a bedtime story, that like there is something ancient about this relationship and this what's playing out, you know. And so once we had that, then it was easy to imagine it's not really Long Beach, it's the kingdom of Long Beach. And you know, it's everything kind of fell into place, that there's both a very real world with these honest characters, and then there's also a fable world where, you know, much deeper things are happening. And that, honestly, like once we had that, it sort of all played forward in a way that was incredibly useful.
I think the definitions of what feels like a broadcast show and a cable show and a streaming show are very subjective, and you know what I call a cable show might play different things in my head than what you mean when you say the same thing. But this feels more like a streaming show than a cable show to me. It doesn't feel noted. It doesn't bend over backwards to explain things. I mean, I found the pilot, I think, a little bit confusing in ways that when I went back and watched it after seeing several episodes, I was okay with it because I was being dropped into a world and not told exactly how to think about everything, which I think you see a lot in a broadcast show and in a lot of cable shows where there's a lot of care to make sure that everybody understands everything that's happening. As it's happening, did you think about those kinds of things? Am I describing the show as you recognize it?
You are, you know, and I think a couple of things we talk about in the room is we never want to hold the viewer's hand. We want to activate the viewer. You know, we're not doing crazy plot stuff, even though there's crazy stuff does happen, but we creating an atmosphere in which certain details in the background, offhand lines of dialogue, all have a kind of prophetic quality to them. And for viewers, I think the show can hopefully be enjoyed as, you know, you just move through it and enjoy it, the ride with the characters. But there's a lot more going on under the surface, and it kind of fulfills, hopefully the show enacts the almost the philosophy of the Lynx and their alchemical vision, that it is a process of learning to see with new eyes. And, you know, we hope we have made a show that rewards a second viewing, in a sense, that you will see things you missed the first time. And we're okay with that. You know, we've learned to live with that.
It's not even okay. I think we really, the intent was to engage an audience. And I have worked on, I will say their name out loud, several CBS shows, and the mantra there is clarity. But I think for us, clarity means disengagement. You know, when everything is explained to you, you can be playing a game on your phone and watch a show and it doesn't matter. Yeah. I think we really wanted to kind of train the audience to lean in. And, you know, even the way we frame the comedy is very loose. Like there's things that are happening, which, you know, we don't call attention to. And that for us creates an audience member that wants to pay attention and is looking, as opposed to just kind of being fed, you know, the details of a story.
David Pascassi is an actor that I think most people will recognize as Julia Louis-Dreyfus's ex-husband on Veep. He's extremely different in this show in ways that I wouldn't necessarily have predicted he was capable of doing. Can you talk to me a little bit about the character and what was asked of him in playing this character?
Sure. I mean, David really just took that role. He took it. Like his tape that came into us was just incredible, and he just seemed to embody in this particular role that both a gentleness, the mind of a seeker, someone's looking for some higher form of knowledge. Blaze is a healer, but he's also someone, as you learn over time, who's been through the ringer in his life. And, you know, he's kind of poised to go down a rabbit hole, basically, because he is the kind of philosopher scholar of our world. And the scholarship of alchemy is insane.
Yeah. No, and David has that, you know, he has that horsepower inside him that, I don't know. He just devoured the role. He yeah. really did. We honestly cast him off a tape he made yeah. that where he was Blaze, and yeah. you know, we never looked back.
Yeah, he's very funny. I think in a lot of the ways that Wyatt Russell is funny, it's a little jangly, a little odd, a little loose. I mean, I think the two of them are really, I think as much as anybody else, are the tone of the show.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I think, I think David's comic chops, which are second to none, help us in many ways. And I think Wyatt, like we were saying, has that kind of in his bag. Maybe a character like Ernie, who's played brilliantly by Brent Jennings, is more of a straight man. In a certain sense, and you could say the same possibly for Sonya Cassidy as Liz, but they also have their own crazy stuff going on. You know, I think Blaze might just kind of embody like the more crazy aspect of the show, the kind of the flight of fancy in the alchemical world.
This feels like an unintentional post-Trump show. I don't know exactly when you wrote it, but I assume it was before November 2016. It feels like it's tangentially about an economy that's serving some people really well and other people not well at all. This is about a company town where the company is leaving. I'm at least in so far as what I've seen, you haven't really explained why the company is leaving, but it would be pretty easy for me to understand that the company's leaving because it has automated, you know, a lot of the employment expenses out of the way it makes its widgets. Is that some of the post-Trump world that you see in the show?
I don't know. I think the overlap, I mean, we were as much talking about the post-trauma of the crash of 08 as anything in terms of economy, but I think if you're looking for overlap with the current environment, I would just look at a major theme of this series is cons and con jobs. And I, you know, for what it's worth, that seems to be in the ether now, the sense of, you know, kind of putting one over on people and some people being in the know and some people not. So,
well, there is certainly a lot of, I think part of this is the there's so many shows being made. I think the last FX number was 430 something or 470 something scripted shows this year, that you're going to have some serendipity. I mean, you're going to have some shows that were written in one context that are all of a sudden going to look very different when you hold them up to the current world. And yeah, I mean, I think this is definitely one of those shows that, whether by prescience on your part or accident or some combination of the two, are really in an interesting conversation with what's happening in the world right now.
Yeah, I just, you know, neither Peter and I are smart enough to do anything that prescient. No,
but we're also too lazy to move that fast.
Yeah, so the combination of laziness and stupidity, I think, has hopefully helped us along. I think it's that you get in trouble if once you start writing something beyond your characters. And, you know, the pilot was written scene by scene, and we move that way in our writing. I think naturally, though, we have a lot of really smart, wonderful writers in our room, and their antenna's up, and it does, you know, it does get in there in some ways. But those larger stories, they write on the back of the characters themselves.
If there's any intent, you know, if nothing else, I think we feel our show is a bit of optimism.
Yeah.
And that was a conscious reaction, I think, to just the general oppressive sense of a darkness and you know, political or climate, whatever you want to feel out there. I think we just wanted to feel that our show portrayed optimism as something other than weak.
Give me some better adjectives than whimsy for what you're doing tonally. Because, I mean, I guess to come back to the beginning, to describe the show makes it sound more dour, I think, than the experience of actually watching it. It's odd, whimsical. Is that how you think about it?
Probably the best word to use, it's a German word. I think Schopenhauer came up with it. It basically is like the German word for dramedy, which is bummer farce.
It's a bummer farce.
Yeah.
I like it. That sounds like a great place to stop.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I appreciate you talking to me. It's an interesting show. I'm looking forward to seeing the other seven, I think, episodes that I haven't seen yet. I know on Comcast Xfinity, you've got 3 episodes up right now, which is, I think, the third episode is airing Monday. So I think you put some episodes out ahead.
Yeah, well, if you are a AMC Premium member, I forget what they call their service, but Premiere, right. You can binge all 10 immediately, which is probably, honestly, the best way to see the series. Although, week to week is fun, too, if you can stand the commercials.
Well, I think that goes back to the idea of, I mean, not to discourage people from watching it on their pay TV accounts right now, but seeing it all at once without commercials might be more satisfying. I saw the episodes that I've seen in screeners, so there were no commercials in what I saw, and it just has a sense of place that you just want to be dropped into.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Jim and I went through the entire process, as you do on a show, without commercials until the day it airs. And there's always a bit of, you know, where art and commerce collide, there's always a bit of stunning, like, amazement for me at how many minutes are devoted to advertising. But we're very happy to have all our sponsors.
Well, I really appreciate you talking to me.
Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot. It was great.